And this is a continuation of the interview with Anadelia Hernandez on the 29th, I guess we decided it was.
Mm-hmm.
Or was it the 20th?
27th.
27th, yeah, right. That's right. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite up to speed yet. the master's program and this administrative program, you were doing that while you were continuing to work at Ainsworth?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
I keep thinking that, you know, we've been putting away for our children for college, and one of the reasons is we don't want them to go through what I went through. I want them to enjoy college and enjoy those college years, because I think you work the majority of your life. Mm-hmm. And if anything, if I were to do anything again, I would have loved to gone to those dances in college, done a little more socializing, and not had to work as much. So yes, I was going to school all day, you know, working, and then at night I was going to the classes and doing my master's program.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't odd for you to see me with my, you know, one kid in a backpack. Now I had Jessica, so she was in my backpack and the other one with me, because I would take them to my classes with me.
Uh-huh.
And that was just kind of, again, you know, if I do this, this is what I have to do. So I did that. It was a program through Lewis and Clark and Portland State. So some of our courses were at Lewis and Clark and some of our courses were at Portland State. And we were just divided in the middle. And so we were actually registered at one or the other schools. So I could have done it at Lewis and Clark too. There wasn't any difference. It was a partnership. But it was wonderful. And if anything, again, the knowledge base it gave me about cultural sensitivity, because now, for the first time, I was with a group of all people of color where we could talk about what are the issues that are facing us. And it went back to those things that I was talking about at college, at law school, that it's not us who have the problems. It's those who are looking at us that are having those perceptions and have put up the barriers. And what is it that we can do to break those barriers down? Because again, I live as a minority all the time in whatever I do, but they don't have those opportunities many times to be with minorities.
Mm-hmm. You moved on from Ainsworth to Echo Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how that happened?
I have to tell you that in there, that last year, right before I went to Echo Shaw, Michael, I decided I wanted to pass the bar exam.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you that too, because I noticed on your resume that you
are
a member of the bar.
For some reason, I decided that it was very important for me to do that again. And I ended up receiving something from the Oregon State Bar that said, we have this tutor program if you're interested. It's a tutoring program that if you're interested, let us know. And it went out to all the minority, I don't think it went to all minority, but it went to all the people who had graduated from law school but maybe had not passed the bar.
Okay.
Most of a minority. I think they did focus on minority, but I'm not really sure. And it was spring break, and I thought it was a week, maybe 2 weeks before spring break, and we were going to take the kids to Disneyland. And I called them and I said, I want to do this. And I've been out of law school for 10 years. Can I do this? And they, if I could have seen their face, I would have loved to, because there was silence at the other end of the phone, you know. And they said, well, yes, you can register. And I said, okay, when do the classes start? Spring break. And I went, what? And they go, spring break, you start all day classes, and then they give you, it's starting spring break because the exam is in July, and you're on a pretty tight schedule. So I looked at Joey and Jessica and said, Joey and Jessica, I'm sorry, we're not going to Disneyland. Mom's going to, you know, have to go to school. They were real good about it. You know, they actually were better than I was. I think I was devastated of, oh, that guilt, you know, as a mom, oh my gosh. But I did it. And I went and I just dedicated. I even still have my schedules of what I did, because I scheduled my life away. I scheduled when I'd play with the kids, when I would have my own free time, when I was with my husband, and when I was at work. And I just scheduled my life away, Michael, and was true to that schedule. My parents, bless their heart, they would take the kids when the kids, you know, weren't with me, and they've been very instrumental in all of it. So to make the story kind of short, I worked really hard, and I was still working all day at Ainsworth. And so during my breaks at lunch, I was reading my books. I'd go for walks every day, and I'd take my notes. I put my notes on tapes, so when I would go into work, you know, it was an hour drive into work and an hour drive back, all my notes were on tapes, and so I'd listen to them and listen to them back. When I'd go running, I'd have everything on tape. Anytime I was in the car, I had my notes on tape. And so I just maximized everything that I could. July came, and I went, oh no, I'm not good at multiple questions. Oh no, this does not feel good. And I thought to myself, there's two parts to the exam, the written exam and the multiple choice. And I thought, oh no, this is not good. The other thing was, all the other bar exams, I tried to make it perfect. I got a room downtown Portland. I made sure I slept. I was without the kids. Well, this one was held at in Beaverton, you know where the ice rink is? They used to have a conference center. It was there. I showed up the first day, got a ride, because we only had one car, got dropped off. I forgot my lunch in the car, forgot my purse in the car, forgot my pencils in the car, and thought, this is the first day of the exam. Oh my gosh. Went in, found some pencils, borrowed some pencils from somebody, and thought, I'll make it through the day. Ended up, I sat next to a lady that was very nice, had brought extra lunch. Does God take care of me, Michael? And she said, you know, I'll have lunch with you. And I went, you're not going to believe it. I forgot my lunch. And she said, you're not going to believe it. I brought an extra lunch. So I tell you, for whatever reason, now I believe so much in the Lord. And she was from Happy Valley. I didn't even know there was such a place called Happy Valley. So I still think, was she an angel who sat next to me? Who was this person? Because I never saw her again. But had lunch, did the exam, and I went, you know, did the next day and thought, the multiple exam. And I remember telling this lady, she said, how'd you do? I said, I think I kicked butt on the writing, but that multiple exam, I think I really messed up. And I remember her saying to me, you'll do great, don't worry, just don't give up. And I said, right. Never saw her again. Don't know who she was. The next day, she even saved me a place so I could go back and sit with her. So talking about these barriers, remember, nobody wanted to be with me. And all of a sudden, there was this lady who was like, Anadelia, I'm over here. I saved you a place. Took it and found out that I didn't pass. So I studied again, because the next exam was in February. In February, I took it, and all I did, Michael, was do multiple exams. I did, like, I think it was 300 a day. It was incredible, the amount of exams that I did every day. And I want to say it was 300. I just did them over and over. Pretty soon, I knew them. It was amazing.
So you just studied multiple choice questions, typical questions that might show up on the exam. Is that what
you said? Exactly. I bought every book on multiple choice questions, and every day I did 300, and I, you know, the next day I would read the answers, the next day I'd do 300, read the answers. And what I started to find out was that there was a pattern. Names had been changed, but the patterns were there. So in February, I remember that I was sitting in here, and I thought, oh dear Lord, I need just one more day. Just give me one more day. That's all I need. It was the year it snowed so hard that there was one that the schools and everything was closed,
including the law exam.
Well, including the bar exam. The bar exam was the next day, and I went, I needed this day. So I kind of just—it was actually 2 days before, because I studied really hard, and then the next day I rested, and then the third day was the exam. So it must have been like on a Wednesday and a Thursday, or Thursday Friday exam. But I just remember it snowed so hard, and I went, oh dear Lord, thank you, because remember I had been working it. You know, I was working every day and doing this at night and trying to do this. So anyway, took it and thought, I don't know how I did. That one was kind of a lonely, quiet, again, it was at the same place, went, I took it, and was just alone. It was a very quiet kind of time. My friend on April Fool's Day called me, Michael, and said, her name's Maria Powell, and she said, you passed, congratulations. And I said, Maria, you don't do this to a friend on April Fool's Day. I said, do not do this. She goes, no, I called the state office, you pass. And I cried and cried and cried. I get teary because I thought, you know, 10 years later, who would have thought? Well, then, like a week or so later, Michael, I get 3 offers for jobs as a principal. So I thought, dear Lord, here I am. You know, because there was still always a thought in my mind of, did I not do law because I never passed the bar? You know, there was still that feeling of, is that what did it? Was that the reason I chose this road and not that road? And all of a sudden, here it was again in front of me. And I could choose law, or I could choose this position. Well, I opened up my own office and did some work out of my house, and very quickly realized that I wanted education. And I thought again, what a wonderful opportunity to be Forest Grove School District, the school, you know, the district that I grew up in. You know, if I can go make a difference in Forest Grove, would this not be the best? And so, you know, I think it must have been real close to, you know, I think May that I said yes to Forest Grove School District and went to Forest Grove and thought, what a great thing. Very excited, was, you know, ecstatic about this position, but went into a school that didn't want me. When I went in as a principal at Echo Shaw, Michael, I was given a letter from the staff saying that they did not want me as their principal.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did they know that?
Well, you know what? Those barriers were up again. I call it, you know, that barrier that some of the things that were in the letter, and I someday hope I can find it because it's in my stuff someplace. But I remember reading it and sitting with Sandy Cakebread, who was the counselor at that time. He was the one that was having to give me this news, and saying, "Sandy, it's a perception that they have about me. I only got the job because I was Hispanic. You know, they needed somebody that was Mexican. They needed somebody who spoke Spanish. That's the only reason I received it." And I said, "Sandy, do they know I have a law degree?" And he goes, "I don't think so. Do they know I have a master's?" "I don't think so. They just knew me as Annie." Now remember, I had been there as an assistant. Some of the teachers were still there when I was an assistant.
So they knew you as
Annie.
You were.
Exactly, yeah. And they knew me. That's all they knew. They thought they knew me, but they had no knowledge of who I was, Michael. Nothing about me. And so as I read it, it was more of, you know, they were having to deal with diversity. They were having to deal with a woman coming in. They were having to deal with the woman who was their assistant for some of those teachers, which was a very positive. But I think it was still that, you know, I was a new kid on the block, and the feeling I got was I received that position because of the color I was, but not because of what I had to offer. And so let me tell you, the first staff meeting was very hard because I sat in front of, you know, 30 plus staff members and said, you know, I know you don't want me. I know that, you know, you gave me this letter, and I need to tell you who I am because I'm not sure that you know who I am. So for a couple of hours, I did exactly what I'm doing with you, where I told them my story of where I was, and then I told them my dreams and hopes for us as a group, that I really saw some things that could be done at Echo Shaw, and that I was willing to take them on that dream if they were willing to go with me, and that I had visions and hopes for us as a group, but we all were going to have to work really hard at it because, obviously, I said, you're not happy with me. So I'm going to have to work very hard to get your trust and earn your trust. Could you believe that? I know you were probably thinking it was going to be this wonderful ending. Well, you know, I guess what I can say is the ending is that those who were willing to work with me worked with me to the point where Echo Shaw is an exceptional school. Mm-hmm. 2 years now, an exceptional school. You know, for me to get to meet the governor, now president of the United States, for me to receive the Milken, you know, the Milken Award for, you know, Principal of the Year and get this wonderful prize, you know, an honor that it bestows on me. I mean, it's just incredible. So the ending is wonderful. For me to be married, you know, Michael, I couldn't be happier in my life. Mm-hmm. And to know that I haven't stopped dreaming. You know, it's like you haven't seen nothing yet. That it can continue. It can mm-hmm. continue.
What was the result of that first staff meeting? Did people still walk out of the room skeptical, do you think?
I think that people walked out of the room, maybe some with their tail between their legs like a dog, you know, kind of, oh, because they might have said some things based on what they thought they knew about me. And so I think it was kind of that whole rumor stuff, that all of a sudden now they had knowledge. I had empowered them with information about me. They knew now who I was. It wasn't what they thought they knew. But I empowered them with knowledge, and now I had to walk the talk. I had to really, you know, my actions now had to align with what I said and what I believed. And so I think the first year it was still, she's not for real, you know, let's test her out. You know, if I would say something, there was a reason of why it couldn't be done. And so that whole change, you know, I tell people, if you haven't read Who Moved My Cheese, it's a wonderful book, and it's probably like an hour long. And I actually did that with my staff this year. But, you know, it was people who, I mean, remember, a handful of those teachers had been there since I was there in the 70s. So they were very comfortable. It was a school that the demographics was changing from a predominant English-speaking school to a kinder that was coming in at 50% Spanish-speaking. So they were having to deal with those changes, and now me there. And I say, you know, that I am so thankful for Dr. Nicolai, who was the superintendent at that time, because he gave me the opportunity to step into an administrative role right away and give me the support that I needed to be able to handle those situations. So again, remember what I talk about, protect and defend and mentor? He was another one that was willing to say, "And Adelia, I'm right there. How can I help? What can I do?" He didn't talk for me, but he made sure that he knew he believed in me. And Sandy Cakebread, who was a counselor, and other people around me were there to say, "We believe in you, Ana Delia. Just because they think this way, we believe in you." And so I think that first, at the end of the first meeting, those who spoke were now having to explain why they spoke. Those who didn't speak now were given information to say, "I can speak now and say some things." Mm-hmm. And those who believed in a change and could see that demographics changing, Michael, were willing to say, "I'll go with you, Anadelia, I'll dream with you. Let's go on that together." Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't easy. It was very hard, Michael, the first year. Parents were the same way, you know. There were some parents who were looking at this of, "Oh my gosh, you've got a staff." I mean, because they knew about the letter too. And parents going, "Oh no, the staff don't want her. She's there, and she's saying she ain't going anywhere." You know, what's going to happen? But again, we all believed in the same thing, which was what is in the best interest of children. And my goal was to make sure that we could continue coming to that, that the reason I was there was for kids, and the reason they were there was for kids. And if we could reinvent ourselves, we were going to do it as a group. And I think we did. Mm-hmm. And again, the evidence I accept is, look at how well our children are doing at Echo Shaw. Mm-hmm. And teachers, you know, have said, you know, they'll say, "I remember when you first came in." Mm-hmm. You know, and they were days, Michael, they weren't fun. I mean, we brought in a person, Daniel Duarte, who's a professor at Pacific University, and did some cultural sensitivity things, and we had people crying because, again, you know what? There were many of them that had never been around a person of color. And then to have that person of color in their mind be above them, which in my mind it wasn't. To me, I was the facilitator to the district. You know, what I believed in my role was different than what they believed. They believed of, "She's my boss and she tells me what to do." And what I believed in was, we're a group. We all bring skills. And I only surround myself with the best so that I can give you what you need. And so, you know, for them to hear that over and over was important, and for me to make sure that they heard that, that I was there on their team to make sure. But I did have, you know, a role, and if I had to make decisions, I had no problems making decisions.
And you mentioned that the demographics were changing at the school at mm-hmm. when you first took over. How has that transition been? I mean, the part of it that you've been able to observe anyway.
Yeah, it's been wonderful because the transition, when I saw it, hadn't happened at kinder. And then the first year it did, I kept saying to the fifth grade teachers, fourth, third, second, first, "What are you doing to get ready for 50% Spanish speaking?" Mm-hmm. And they'd kind of look at me, because I think so many times still teachers are within their little box and they can't see the whole school. And so I would bring it up again. What are you doing? You've got 4 years before they come to you. You have three, you have two, you have next year. What are you doing? And so it forced them to get into that reflective mode of what was I doing. And some of the best teachers did not feel comfortable in that kind of an environment because they didn't speak the language. So to let them know that it wasn't about them, but it was because they couldn't speak the language. And so therefore, maybe they needed to go someplace else. They needed to look at another school because the school that they had been in wasn't that school anymore. It doesn't mean that they weren't a good teacher, but they needed to think about where they wanted to be and whether they were there for kids or for a job. And if they were there for a job, we were all there for the wrong reason. We have to make sure our skills are there for the kids.
Mm-hmm. So some people did leave then?
They did. Mm-hmm. 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 I never had to fire anybody. Mm-hmm. I never had to move anybody on an involuntary move. But I did counsel people about, you know, reflecting and looking at where they needed to be, because I wasn't going to accept, this is my school, this is the way I teach. What I was willing to accept is, this is their school, they need this, and I can give it to them. And if they couldn't say that, yes, I was in their face, Michael, about, you know, what do we do? Because again, I'm an attorney for kids. Mm-hmm. My job was to make sure that they got the best thing that they needed.
How about the community, especially the parents of kids enrolled in the school of mainstream kids rather than minority kids? Did they accept? I mean, do they view the change that's taking place at Echo Shaw in a positive way now?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
And if so, how did you pull that one off?
How did I pull it off? You know, I didn't have to pull off anything. I think giving people, again, empowering them with information and empowering them with the ability to make change happens. Mm-hmm. And what I think I did is that with the parents, yeah, there were some parents, Michael, that didn't want me there. And they also, you know, I go back to that they walked in with a perception of, it's a woman, it's Hispanic, she's Mexican, da 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 da. And I knew that they were walking in with that attitude. And I chose not to fight those battles.
Mm-hmm.
I kept it all very geared to, I'm about kids, how can I help you? And when it became that battle, I would say, you know, apparently you have some concerns, but I'm not going to talk about my ethnicity or my racial background. I'm going to talk about why I called you or why you're here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd always try to bring it back to that. That if they had that concern or that issue, that was their own personal issue. I wasn't going there with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the more years I did that, you know, the better it's gotten. But I'll have people come in and say, you know, you Mexican, you're going to make this school a Mexican school. Because the perception was, I was there and I was going to make that school a little Mexican school. And what I said was, I have no control over the kids that come there, Michael.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I have no control. You know, I can't go out and say, yes, I will bring all the little Mexican kids in. I have no control. But what I was saying was, look at what's coming into this school.
Mm-hmm.
And if I speak Spanish and I can bring Spanish speaking skills into this school, does it not make sense to do that? Now, if you hate the fact that I'm here, how can I help you? Because again, I ain't leaving.
Mm-hmm.
So let's work this out. So the parents were able to come around and they saw it as the dual language, Michael. What a wonderful opportunity for kids who don't speak Spanish. So they saw it as a positive.
Okay.
But yes, you know, you always have a couple parents that, you know, I had one parent just this last year, which is really, I mean, just like in September, come in with a little black book that says, this is America, and these are the American rights, and everyone should speak English. And I had not seen anything like that. And I, you know, my superintendent was sitting with me on that meeting, and that was a scary one because it was almost very white supremacist type kind of meeting, which, you know, I had not seen in a long time. And you know, they chose to pull their child out, and I said, fine, you know, that's your choice. We're not doing anything that's unethical or immoral. You know, this is our school, and this is how we chose to continue.
Mm-hmm. I guess I talked earlier about your parents and Centro a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if you've had any involvements with Central or any of the other community organizations that are part of the Hispanic community since you were a teenager, since your career.
You know, with my family and with the new marriage, I still say new even though it's going on 4 years, seems like just yesterday. I am very intentional about my time, Michael, and I'm very kind of almost protective of my time, that I, at this point in my life, I don't have that time to put in to those kind of organizations. But I feel that I do it through our school. And the reason I say that is because we have a lot of parent meetings, and what I try to do is bring the cultural, you know, that they're community meetings, not just parent meetings, but that the whole community is invited. We do a community, you know, fair at the school. So I invite all the organizations to put up a booth at the school. And so in a way, if anything, what I believe is that my experience with growing up with the Centro has allowed me to see the positives that a school could have as a community entity. Mm-hmm. And that it's not just a school, it's a community entity and a resource to the community. And so though I'm not as active in the Centro, you know, Sister Barbara and Sabino, they'll call me if they want me to do anything, and I'd be more than happy to. And they sometimes hold their ESL classes at our school. Mm-hmm. So again, it's that bridging of the community. Again, at the drop of a hat, I'll do anything for Pacific University. If they call me today and say, can you make it today at 4, I'll stop everything and make it there at 4. So I do it that way, where I give back to them on an as-need basis. Mm-hmm. Because right now in my life, that position alone, I do so much outreach, and I have my own family.
Sure.
But I hope in the future that I can continue to some way be involved. And so that's probably, you know, when people ask me to be on boards or be on, you know, I ask, does it have to do with kids? Is it going to help me with the kids I have now? And if any of those are no, then I say I can't right now. Uh-huh. Because I want to dedicate my time to my children, which are the 540 at Echo Shaw and the 3 I have here at home.
Maybe just a final footnote. How did you meet your second husband?
That could be another hour, Michael. Well, Michael, my husband, his name is Michael Douglas Schofield, and he is the business manager for our district. And so we knew each other on a professional basis, and I admired him since the first time I met him. He is 10 years younger than I am. And so part of my admiration for him was, you know, such a young person, so professional, such high, you know, talking about knowledgeable about what he does, just incredible. And me being brand new as I walked in was able to just give me lots of information to help me budget-wise, money-wise, with my position. It ended up that when I was going through my divorce, he had just gone through his a while back, but we really didn't know each other on a personal view like that. And, you know, I think things happen for a reason. My superintendent said, you know, when I was going through my divorce, I needed a whole business or budget kind of, you know, a whole, what is it called, a plan on my whole income and expense to turn into the judge. And my superintendent at that time said, oh, Mikey will help you. So he came over and helped me, and I was a basket case. I think I just had a box of just all these receipts, and he had to put it into some kind of an order for me. Well, then in November, he had got tickets. Joey, my son, loves hockey, and he got free tickets to a suite at the Coliseum at the Rose Garden. And so I took the kids, and they knew him as Money Man Mike, because I'd always call him Money Man Mike. This was in November. In March, for spring break, we were in Disneyland. Remember that Disneyland I always promised them?
Right.
Wouldn't you know it, as I'm a single mom, Michael, I have to take him down there. Michael is down there with his little boy. We see each other once, never see each other again. Then I have my 20th school year reunion, and...
Hold on. Go ahead.
And we had our, it was my summer of, my life is all together. I've been dating, and I now, my life is together. I now know I can, you know, handle a house payment, a car payment, children, vacation. And I'm, you know, look out, because I'm going to rule the world, Michael. And I have my high school reunion. I'm looking great. Things are wonderful. And it's his birthday. It's his 30th birthday in October. And about a week later, he says, "Anatolia, why don't we go have dinner?" I said, "Sure, not a problem. We'll go have dinner." I came home, told the kids, on Friday I'm going out to dinner with my friend. My kids had gone to all the dates I had been on. And they went, "Oh, it's a date, we get to go with you?" And I said, "Are you kidding? It's my friend." "Go away, you guys. You're not going. It's my friend." Went Michael, and he took me to, this is terrible. I just forgot the place downtown Portland. It's a very, very nice restaurant that has also the hotel. Heathman. Thank you, Jessica. He would not have ever forgiven me for that one. The Heathman. And we had this beautiful dinner. And I hadn't gone out to nice dinners like that. So I was like, "Oh my gosh, they do little, you know, things with your syrup on your ice cream. I go, look at this." And, "Oh, you mean I order a salad first?" And then, you know, so I was just having a great time, having a wonderful time. And I drove there and met him. And as I drove away, I looked in my rearview mirror and I said, "Oh dear Lord, it's him. I'm going to marry him. It's him." This whole time, it's been him. Everything I ever wanted. He's a professional. He has integrity. He has, you know, a vision for his life. He had full custody of his little boy, which we now have. He believes in family. It's him. And I looked at him in the rearview mirror as I drove away and cried all the way home, thinking it's Michael. Now, is that like crazy? Went back and went Monday morning to my office, and my secretary goes, "So how was it?" Because my whole office had always said, "You and Mikey would be great. You know, you guys would be awesome." And I'd say, "The kid." I actually was trying to set him up for my niece, Michael, before that. I just thought of him as a really great person. But I thought, we're 10 years different. I've got two kids. You know, why would anybody want me with two kids and a whole, you know, he had too much going for himself. Would go to Alaska, had very good friends, you know, liked basketball, you know, everything was perfect for him. So I said, "I'm going to marry him," and my secretary about died, and she just looked at me, and she goes, "Does he know that?" And I said, "No, but he'll figure it out." And she just laughed. Well, to make the story short, I believe that for, you know, God puts us in the places for whatever reason, that I was not able to see everything he had to offer until that night that I saw. And he proposed, beautiful ring, proposed the way I always dreamed I was going to have a proposal. He proposed to me in Phoenix, Arizona on New Year's Eve. The children had already known. We were there for a wedding of a friend's. The kids already knew. They had already seen the ring. They had already said yes. My dad already knew. I was the only one that didn't know he was going to propose. Proposed in Phoenix at this beautiful resort. And we decided we were going to get married in the summer. And then went, why? Why not get married now? We got married on Valentine's Day, February 14th. And now, you know, like I said, it just seems like yesterday. Again, I think we were at the right place at the right time. He is 10 years younger, but is 10 years ahead of me in his career, in the sense of where he's going. And we dream together, and we're growing together, and we believe that 10 years from now we'll still be together, and 20 years from now, because we believe that neither one of us is going to let the other one get behind. Because we will grow. We know that 10 years from now we're not going to be the same, and 20 years from now. And again, you know, one of my fears was, he's white. I know it sounds terrible, but I was like, what if? Because I do, you know, you hear me, I speak to the kids in Spanish. I listen to Spanish music. I cook Spanish food. I'm still very Mexican in my culture. And, you know, how was he going to deal with my little saints on my walls and the colors that I choose? And what I realize is, like I said, he accepts me. And that's the big thing, is accepts me and supports me. And again, I think he was able to take me to a different level in my own career, because he helped me. He could help me grow. While before, you know, I was as good as I could get, because I didn't have anybody else around me to encourage me, to mentor me, to have me continue going. And he does that for me.
So how long was it after looking in the rearview mirror and realizing it's him?
Let's see.
To the time that he proposed.
Well, 3 months, let's see, 2 hours, 40, no. Yeah, it was October 15th and January 1st.
Okay.
He proposed, you know, at midnight. And it was so cute because I called my kids, you know, right away and said, you know, Michael, he proposed, and they're all, yes, say yes, we all know, say yes. Because again, my family was so much a part of me that if they weren't, you know, going to accept this, I did not want anything. But no, it was too natural. Uh-huh. It was just too natural.
And do you think that's why Michael went to your dad and talked to your kids first to make sure that everything was set up ahead of time? Or?
Yeah, you know, I think that for Michael, I've never asked him, but I would like to believe that he had the same kind of moral standards. Of he knew still that even though I was on my own with my children, that my parents were still very much a part of me. And that he knew that I would ask for their blessing on anything that I did. And again, that's where I go back to that awareness that he had on cultural sensitivity. That, you know, somebody else might have just said, hey, it's you and I, baby, you know, forget them. But he saw that, you know, even though I was very independent, my parents were very much a part of me and continue to be a part of me. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was out of respect, and that he knew what I was about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Anadelia. Well, this has been a great story from beginning to end.
Good.
Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you'd like to say a few words about mm-hmm. now?
I think if anything, that as people listen to the story and as they reflect, that they know that there were very, very hard times, and that sometimes I didn't even know the hard times. You know, I was protected from those hard times, and at times I did know them, but I saw them as a positive. And that also during my life, that I did have those mentors. And so whether I was talking about, you know, the elementary school or the junior high or the high school or the college, there were still people there that gave me that encouragement. And that whoever listens to this tape, I challenge them and I encourage them to go find somebody that they can mentor, because we all do make a difference. And it's not one person saving one person, but it's hundreds dealing with, you know, people and being touched by hundreds. And somewhere I was blessed because I was touched by a lot of people at different times of my life, whether it was my ugly divorce or my beautiful wedding. But you're touched all the way through your life, and that we continue doing that. And maybe it's not connecting with community organizations, but going to schools, you know, giving that one day a month or giving that one time a year that you go. But give back to your community, give back to wherever you're at. And if anything, that would be my, you know, that I want to end with that as I reflect on my life, there were so many roads that I could have taken, and yet somebody was there helping me giving me information to make decisions. Mm-hmm. And that it could have been totally different. I could have ended up like statistic, pregnant, dropped out, not graduated from high school, not had a career, and that for whatever reason, you know, I was blessed with some opportunities that I took advantage of, and not to give up. You know, that the courage is that when you're on the ground, and I was there in many situations, that the courage is to get yourself up and still say, I can do this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Anadelia, well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to give us this interview.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Michael.